Okay, so good morning, everybody. So I'll be talking primarily about the recent experiment on modulating the Casimir force with light, and which has motivated some theoretical developments, and I'll just go through that and tell you. That's going to be my primary bulk of my talk. So just a background, so I'm an experimentalist. And so our primary technique for, you know, we've been working on measuring the Casimir force for a little over a decade now. And the primary technique in all of this is using the atomic force microscope, the SenStudio atomic force microscope, which was, you know, the instrument was developed to its, was fine-tuned, let's say, at UCSB. So it's based on the idea that you have a very thin cantilever, which is not showing up. It's too thin to see here. So, and if there's a very small force between the sphere and a plate, the sphere is attached to the cantilever, and the cantilever responds by flexing. It's so thin, it's usually an order of 1,000 angstroms or so. It bends down, and you record the deflection of this cantilever by bouncing a laser beam off this top of the cantilever. And that's a basic technique. And what we did was usually it's used for atomic force microscopes are used for imaging, you know, topography primarily. What we did was to do the following: attach a large spherical surface to this cantilever, which we did around 1998, and showed that we can use this to make the Casimir force measurement. So here's this cantilever, which is this triangular cantilever, and the reason we use a triangular one is you get side-to-side stability. And the cantilever flexes only in the vertical direction. So we attached this polystyrene sphere and then put a layer of typically gold on top of the polystyrene sphere. And the reason we picked the polystyrene sphere over 10 years ago was for a couple of reasons. One is it's made from the liquid phase. Since it's made from the liquid phase, it's a liquid drop, so it's perfectly spherical. So the roughness is very, very small. That's a big advantage of the polystyrene sphere.
Does gravity not disturb?
Yes, so, and the other is the mass of the sphere. Since it's polystyrene, it's very light. Its specific gravity is 1.4, 1.3. It's very light, so you can put it on a cantilever and not destroy the cantilever. Okay, so that's the, so
gravity. I meant gravity, I mean, that you get a deformation from spherical.
Oh, I mean, they make it in a liquid phase, in a phase, it's a mixture, uh-huh. And they let it cool down. So it's, you know, gravity is very low, it's buoyant.
It's much smaller than the gravitational length scale, so it shouldn't affect.
Yeah,
capillary length, what's called, right? I think it's much smaller in size.
So this is about 200 micron is the diameter, and we stick to what happens. We tried going to larger spheres, like 300 microns and 400 microns. It gets rougher, the surface, so that's why we don't go to larger spheres.
Actually, since you have this picture, what are the other beam bars for? I mean, you
can use this one or this one. We make a variety. They have different force sensitivities, and this has the best force sensitivity, so we stick with this one. Yeah, and you know, we can engineer the size of the beams and the shape of the beams. And this one is a picture from an experiment where we use this for sensitivity. So the advantage is, I mean, it's very light and it's perfectly smooth, and then you put a metal in. So that's something we did 10 years ago and started using. And now it's become a standard in Casimir force measurements to use this kind of technique, a polystyrene sphere coated with a metal, as you must have seen in all the other experiments. So you put this cantilever, sphere supported with this cantilever, and you measure the force between the sphere and the plate. And typically, the cantilever sensitivity is theoretically predicted to be about 10 to the minus 17 newtons. The best we can do is about 10 to the minus 13 so far. Okay, so that's our limit sensitivity.
What limits this sphere?
Well, it's actually the noise associated with the fact that we have this large sphere on the cantilever. And the fact that, you know, we can, unlike in a atomic force microscope, we just have a silicon or silicon nitride cantilever. We have to do a couple of things. We have to coat this whole thing with metal. Okay. Typically, the outside layer has to be gold because gold is very non-reactive. But the problem is, once you put gold and then we bounce the laser on the other side, we're bouncing a laser to look at the deflection. There's a differential heating of the system. Okay, so to counter that, we have to put multiple layers of metal to compensate for the thermal expansion mismatches. Okay, so we have to, and these are the kind of things we worked out 10 years ago, what kind of metal layers to put to counteract the thermal expansion mismatch. And they all add noise to the system. They drift. So essentially, since you're heating from one side, you always have drift in the system. And you have to wait for a time when the drift is very small, make the measurement. And these are systematic effects in the experiment that you have to counter with, which limits the resolution. So noise associated with the cantilever, effectively, and the fact that you have this large sphere of it. Okay, so using this AFM, we made a series of measurements starting from over 10 years ago. So we did the, you know, this is where we showed the technique that you can attach the sphere and create a metal coated cantilever. You need a metal coating, again, for all the electrostatic calibration and electrostatic study, the electrostatic systematics. That's why you need the whole, all the surfaces to be wrapped in metal so you can get the electrostatic systematics out. And so in terms of just measuring the normal Casimir force, we show that, you know, at a 95% confidence level, just the experimental error, and again, this is just experimental error, you know, random error plus systematic error, as a ratio of the total force. So you measure a force, and this is the fractional error as a function of the force is about 1.75%. And this is at a 95% confidence level, I mean, by which we mean that you take your error. You know, this is based on a student's t-test, where if you want to compare a theory to an experiment, then you have to talk about confidence levels. And to get a 95% confidence level, you take your error and multiply it by a factor of 2, and then compare it to the theory and see if the theory matches or not, within the error bars or not. That tells you whether the theory matches to 95% confidence level. If you wanted to match it to 70% confidence level, then you just have the error bars alone. So 95% means you multiply it by a factor of 2. If you want to compare it to 99.9%, you multiply the error bars by a factor of 3, and the theory and experiment match, you say, gee, I got something at a 99.9% confidence level, or the theory is ruled out at 99.9% confidence. That's how we apply. You compare a hypothesis, a theoretical hypothesis, to an experiment. So in this case, what we do is, so in our case, 95% confidence level means with a factor of 2 in the error bar, we multiply and take the ratio. Error divided by the force, and that's 1.75%. That's just experimental, plain experiment. Okay, now if you want to match it to theory, then you go see what the errors in the theory are, and there's errors in the theory. I mean, for example, on a metal, there was a paper that if you make a very poor metallic film compared to a good metallic film, there's a range in the reflectivity. For example, if you put a very thin layer of metal on a surface, the reflectivity is very poor. And if you put a thick layer of metal, you know, with very low porosity, then the reflectivity is very high, and you can compare the two. And there's a theory paper published last year by Piroshenko et al. And Svetoy and all these people, saying that there can be a 5% variation in the reflectivity, based on the reflectivity. Okay, so that's a theory, that's separate. This is just an experiment, you can just compare the experimental errors. Now you match experiment and theory and make a comparison and see how well you're doing, and there are a couple of ways of doing that. With the error bars, you can compare the theory. You can have a band for the errors in the theory and compare the theory and experiment, and I'll talk about how we do that. And also, the nice thing about the Casimir force is you're making the Casimir force measurement as a function of separation. You're not making it one separation distance. You're making it as a function of separation. And if even the Casimir force is very nonlinear, it goes as 1 over d to the fourth if it's an ideal metal. It's even more nonlinear if the metal is not a perfect metal, because the reflectivity of the metal changes as a function of separation distance. The Casimir force is a very nonlinear function of separation. So now you can compare experiment and theory based on this nonlinearity and see if the experiment and theory match over the whole separation region within the error bar. So it's a very powerful technique when you compare it as a function of separation. You're not comparing it at one particular point. You're comparing it as a range of separation. And then the statistics get very good in comparing experiment and theory, and you can rule out a lot of theories at a very high confidence. And that's what you need to do. So, you know, sometimes people say, oh, no, you know, we don't understand the theory at 5%. That's, you know, that's not a realistic comparison. You have to compare as a function of separation within the experimental error bars, each taken separately. Theory error bars, experimental error bars, each taken separately, and make a realistic comparison between the two as a function of separation, not at one particular point. So the theory errors are separate, and you compare the force, which is a nonlinear function of distance, because the reflectivity is a nonlinear function of distance, and the Casimir force itself is a nonlinear function of distance. So then we did some experiments almost a decade ago where we measured the Casimir force between a corrugated surface and the same sphere, metal-coated sphere. This experiment had one flaw, which was the fact that the way we arranged the corrugations, we couldn't distinguish between the lateral Casimir force and the normal Casimir force in this experiment.
Which Casimir force?
Lateral Casimir force, which comes from these two corrugations, and the theory was done earlier to our experiment by Maron and his co-workers and Omega and others, and lots of theory done on this. And so we did this experiment in 2002 and 2003, where we measured the lateral Casimir force. And this experiment was complicated because we couldn't distinguish between a normal and a lateral. We couldn't separate them out at the time. So so then we went on and did the measuring the Casimir force between metals and semiconductors, looking at the dependence of the dielectric constant and how it changes with the dopant density of the semiconductor, and the change in the carrier density in the semiconductor, and look at the change in the Casimir force. And that brings me to the subject of today's talk, which is also done in semiconductors, which is a progression in a series of experiments, where we measured the optical modulation of the Casimir force using a semiconductor. Okay, and that's what I'll be spending the bulk of my time talking about. Yes?
Are you going to tell us a little bit more about the theory you're comparing with?
Yes, I'm going to tell you a little bit more, yes. Okay, so the...
Can you just go back one ref I wanted to say?
Yes.
So it's
OptX. Yes. And this is a long paper. Fizer of B, yeah. Optics Express, and this Fizer of B is the long paper.
Optics Express.
And Fizer of B is...
The experiment done at room temperature?
Yes, these experiments I'm going to talk about are done at room temperature. Yes, and I'm going to get to that, yes.
So yeah. Your screening length could be of order of a micron?
Well, it depends on the density, dopant density, yes. And it's actually, for our lowest dopants, about 200 nanometers or so.
Yeah. If it's intrinsic, it could be
out. Yeah, intrinsic would be out. But you don't want to use intrinsic, so I'll tell you. Ask me the question again.
Just recently.
Yes. And I'll tell you why you don't want to use intrinsic. Okay. Okay. All right. So so our goal here is, of course, to demonstrate the optical modulation of the Casimir force. That's from an application point of view. And there are some puzzling applications of the Casimir force, puzzling applications of the Lipschitz theory when applied to dielectric materials. And this will show up in our experiment because we will go from a dielectric phase of silicon to a metallic phase, and that's how we'll probe this, how to apply the Lipschitz theory. And I'll tell you what these puzzling applications are. All of you know about the slide, so I won't tell you anything about this slide. So we're applying the Lipschitz theory. And so this is the formula for the Lipschitz theory, for a sphere and a plate, surface 1 and surface 2, where the radius of the sphere is much larger than separation distance between these two surfaces. These are the reflection coefficients, RTM and RTE are the reflection coefficients, expressed here in terms of the imaginary frequency. So wherever I have frequency, I'll just replace I times C here. And this is at a finite temperature T. So this is a finite temperature Lipschitz formula in terms of the reflection coefficients. So the reflection coefficients are given here. This subscript denotes whether it's surface 1 or surface 2. And it's expressed in terms of these C, which are the Matsubara frequencies. L is an integer going from 0 to infinity. And in particular, I'll be talking about the term L is equal to 0, where C goes to 0. It's called the 0 Matsubara frequency. That's where I want to draw your attention to. And the variables Q is given here, Q from the Q sub L is given here, and the variable K is given here. Okay, so these are all the variables in the standard Lipschitz formula, no different here. Now let me get to the puzzles. So here's the puzzles in the application of Lipschitz theory. So here are the reflection coefficients, RTE and RTM, okay, and epsilon here, of course, is the permittivity of the two surfaces, but K would be 1 or 2. And sub L denotes, of course, the Matsubara frequencies. For two metals, if you go to large separation distance, so when you take two metal surfaces, go to large separation distance, you expect to get the Casimir results, the 1 over d to the fourth result. The reason is metals are very highly reflecting at long wavelengths. They have almost 100% reflectivity. That means they're ideal metals. Therefore, you expect the Casimir result. Now, which means that the reflection coefficient should go to 1 to get the Casimir result, the ideal metal result. Now, what happens is, of course, the permittivity of metals are very high. They go to infinity. You can substitute infinity in these reflection coefficients. And you find out that to get, if at finite temperature, if you do this Lipschitz expression out, the L is equal to zero term dominates in terms of numerical value. It dominates the expression at large distances. So this term dominates, but to get this term, and if you want to get this reflection coefficient, Milton, DeRide, and Schwinger found this. They found this way back in 78. They found that you have to put epsilon equals infinity first before you put L and C equal to zero next. If you do the reverse order, then you don't get the Casimir result. You get half the Casimir result. Okay, this was a puzzle they figured out, and they said, gee, we know this is a problem, so what we're going to do is we're going to do the special approach, which is we're going to put, you know, epsilon is equal to infinity first before we put C is equal to zero, before we go to zero Matsubara frequency. Okay, so this was a trick. They commented on this and said, this is what you got to do. Then we get the ideal Casimir force resolved at large separation distances. Okay.
Because one of those two
goes to zero when you put the epsilon in here.
But didn't Lipschitz also point out that he can get Casimir result from
the formula? Yes. I mean, you know, Lipschitz pointed out, yes, for infinite, but he didn't exactly say, you know, he didn't take...
He didn't say how he got it.
Okay. He said he got the Casimir result. Okay. So obviously he knew it too. And I'm going to tell you, he knew about something else also, which I'm going to tell you the next puzzle, okay, which he didn't comment on, but he obviously knew about it. But Schwinger was the one who first pointed out, gee, you know, I got to do this if I'm going to get the ideal Casimir result from this formula. Okay.
Lipschitz in this paper, he basically zero temperature limit, and then that's not an issue.
Exactly. That's also true. Yes. Yes. That's also true. But I'm going to come to another puzzle, which he, you know, which he did something but didn't comment on a problem with that. Okay. So,
I think the calculation of Lipschitz was the first one that has been done at finite temperature.
The calculation of Schwinger, you mean? Lipschitz is the first finite temperature calculation, non-ideal metal. Non-ideal, I mean, you mean his theory is the first non-ideal metal finite temperature result, you mean?
Even ideal metal finite temperature came after, I think.
Well, you know, he did finite temperature and non-ideal metals.
He was
the first one to do it. He was obviously the first one to do it, yeah. I skipped that slide, yeah. I didn't want to, that was a slide I skipped on the chronology. After Casimir, he was the first one to do the finite temperature and non-ideal metals, yeah. So, and you know, it gets, so what happens now? So if you take a real metal, okay, which means that you don't, you're not going to the infinite epsilon as for an ideal metal. So if you take a real metal, and the most appropriate description of the permittivity would be in terms of the Drude formula, where I have some finite relaxation coefficient. Here, this is of course a plasma frequency, omega p, and this is just the frequency, imaginary frequency, instead of omega squared, I just replaced it by I times c here. And you go to the zero Matsubara, because now you cannot do the Schwinger application, you just can't put infinity, because now you're putting the real permittivity here, okay? So you're stuck with the real permittivity, you can't do this infinity thing here. So you put the zero Matsubara frequency, and then you see, you get that, you know, half the Casimir result, even at large separation distances, which is physically non-intuitive because you expect the ideal Casimir force result at large separation distances, okay? You get only half, only one of the reflection coefficients is one, the other goes to zero. Mm-hmm. So this is the problem, and...
What's what I would call the London or Van der Waals
effect? No, it's not quite. This is half, you know, this is at large separation distances. This is retarded now. Yes, it's still large, but you expect the ideal Casimir force result. Okay,
so
but you get half of it exactly.
It's just a temperature effect, is it?
No, this shows up when you do the temperature. When you do the zero temperature, Lipschitz formula does not show up.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it has something to do with the temperature. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm going to tell you a little bit. Yes, I'm going to get to that next point about the temperature problem. Okay, so you get only half the but you get half exactly half, which is a weird thing. It's not some fraction. It's half. Mm-hmm. Telling you, you know, somehow one of the coefficients should be one. It's not one. Okay. Then the other thing is you get a large thermal correction. So let's say you're doing this experiment at room temperature, 300 Kelvin. Then the black body spectrum peaks at 7 microns. So we expect, you know, when you're doing an experiment at 100 nanometers, let's say very short separations, the black body photons, the thermal photons, should not contribute because they are excluded because they are peaking at 7 microns. They're all excluded. But if you do this finite temperature formula, then you get a large thermal correction at 100 nanometers. And in fact, this thermal correction is very nonlinear, and it's strange, which means at 100 nanometers it's large, at somewhere in between, like 500 nanometers, goes to zero, and then starts going up again. So it's, you know, it's not intuitive. I mean, So you get this weird behavior that you get this large thermal correction at 100 nanometers. And the other thing is, you expect the entropy to go to zero as T goes to zero. If you use the Drude formula in the permittivity, you expect the entropy to go to zero by third law. But here, if you do the entropy out, it doesn't go to zero at T equals to zero. It tells you that the minute you introduce this loss term, if you don't have this loss term, if you don't have this gamma, then everything's okay. That's a plasma model, everything is fine. Okay, the minute you put this loss term in the permittivity is when you get these problems. Okay, so it's associated with this loss term here in the theory. So there's a lot of work and a lot of debate on how to do these things out. And
I'm confused. So to get zero entropy, gamma has to be zero or non-zero?
No, gamma has to be non-zero. If you put impurities in your system, so if you go to a non-ideal lattice, then everything's okay. You get a zero entropy. But the entropy behaves weird. I mean, it's non-zero till you get to, you know, absolutely T equals zero, then it jumps up to zero. It's it doesn't smoothly go to zero as you'd expect by Nernst's theorem. You know, it goes to a constant of zero, the entropy. But here, it stays non-zero till you hit temperature zero, then it jumps up. So it behaves weirdly, but it does go to zero if you put impurities in the metal. Okay. Okay. For dielectrics, it's a little bit, it's similar, but a little different. Now again, if you treat the Lipschitz formula at finite temperature for a perfect dielectric, that means you put only a static dielectric constant for the dielectric. Take a piece of glass, you put the static dielectric constant, 3.85, which is what Lipschitz did in his calculations. Everything is okay. But the minute you assume any non-zero conductivity for a glass, and every glass has some non-zero conductivity, 10 to the minus 20 ohms per centimeter, whatever you want, any non-zero conductivity you put into the dielectric, again you get the same puzzles. Okay, so which is probably why Lipschitz put a static dielectric constant into this formula and got the force from it. So again, if you have any non-zero conductivity, you represent that by some plasma frequency and some losses, and you get the same problems. Okay, and then. If you have one metal and one dielectric surface, the reason I talk about this is because that's our experiment, and you have the similar issues, okay, from the fact that you have losses in your system. The fact that you have this gamma in your system gives you similar issues that the one of the reflection coefficients 1, the other is 0, same puzzle as metal, and the important thing I want to draw your attention is it is you can put as small a conductivity as you want for the dielectric, the problem persists. You know, which is what makes it non-physical.
Okay. May I ask you something?
Yeah.
Imagine if you look at a much simpler situation, you just have vacuum and ideal metal plates, but at finite temperature.
Yes. That
everything is fine,
then. If it's ideal metal, no losses, then everything's okay, you got the Casimir result. That's, but still you have to do this trick, remember, of putting epsilon infinity before you go to putting zero frequency. You have to do that trick, but as long as you do that trick, you're okay. Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
When you say you get the same result as Casimir, because he presumably got things by counting the zero-point energies of photon modes. Is that the kind of derivation you're talking about?
Zero-point energy of photon modes and regularizing them, yes.
The one retard end. Right.
Yeah.
Now, in that context, so that's like a sum of zero-point energies type way.
Yes.
And of course, there's the Lipschitz way, which integrates over all frequencies and effectively uses the random phase approximation technique. From a many body point, that's
his okay.
Okay. Now, if you take his something I've noticed recently in a different context, which might be relevant here, if you take the Lipschitz type formula with an integration, well, either up the imaginary axis or along the real axis, doesn't matter, it is not always equivalent to a sum of 0 point energies. It usually is, but if you've got a dielectric function or any kind of response function in there which breaks time reversal invariance, such as one with an artificial gamma, the Lipschitz formula, quite apart from the model, does not give you the same.
Yes, this is the key to the problem. That is the fact that you put a gamma in it,
yes,
violates time reversal invariance. Okay,
this is the key.
Therefore, actually putting the gamma into the formula means that you're out of equilibrium. Because if you think about it physically, you have the 0 point photons heating up the system, in this case the surface, okay, and you're out of thermal equilibrium. That's the key. That's what we think is the key to problem with putting gamma in there. you know, that you're immediately out of equilibrium.
So it's highly model independent, this thing I noticed.
Excuse me?
Highly model independent, this discrepancy that I've noticed.
Yes.
It came up for me in
a yes, yes. It's very basic. It's very basic. You violate time reversal symmetry, mm-hmm. and you out of thermal equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't describe the situation you want to describe, which
on
is.
On the other hand, if you describe that same damping, in a very microscopic way, like an infinite bath of something else, like let's say phonons or something, which doesn't violate time and variance, then with such a proper description of the damping in some sense, by just putting in a lot of other modes to take energy up, presumably you will get the equivalence between the two ways of looking at it. But you'd have to include those.
You know, but the problem here is you don't have an infinite system.
No.
You have a finite system with surfaces, right? We're measuring the force between two surfaces. You don't have an infinite system.
Mm-hmm.
That's when, you know, how do you deal with it? You know, that's a problem.
And I don't want to take
yeah.
any more time. There's a
yeah.
whole lot
no, but,
of issues.
No, that's
a,
that, that is the...
...end of things that might be very relevant for this.
Yeah. No, that, but that is the key point, I mean. Okay.
Once more, I mean, since we ask questions. I mean, you mentioned that 100 nanometers, you have large temperature effect.
Right, large thermal correction.
Can you give a percentage?
You know, I used to have it. I not by the top of my head, but I can get that for you. I have it somewhere on my computer. But it's, you know, because the thermal correction should be almost zero. So what happens is, physically in our experiments, we do a zero temperature calculation. Within experimental errors, we should not be able to tell. But this is, large meaning factors of 1,000 compared to the zero temperature, you know. Again, I can't compare to zero temperature because zero temperature is zero already. I mean, you know, it's very large. I can get you the numbers, yeah.
But
it's also very nonlinear, like I was telling Maron. You know, it goes to zero at 500 nanometers, which is the weirdest thing. The thermal correction goes to zero at some distances.
This is for the semiconductor?
No, this is for metal plates. Metal plates, yeah. Not some, but the same thing will hold. There will be a thermal correction for semiconductor, too. But it won't be as high as for metal.
Can it come from the temperature
dependence
for the
like
function? I mean,
they're
two different kinds.
Oh, yeah, maybe it will not, because it is high doping densities we deal with. It will be a very small effect, the intrinsic thing. But that, so we'll, you know, but even let's talk about ideal metal. It goes to zero at in distances in between, which is the weirdest thing. It's very large at short distances, goes to zero, and changes over in sign. So it's supposed to be negative at some distances, positive at some distances, it goes to zero in between, which is a weird thing. You know, so the thermal correction is negative at some places.
Yes. It's often the opposite sign.
Opposite sign, and it goes to zero in between. Yeah, yeah. So this is a weird thing. Okay. All right, so I'm going to talk about the experiment there now. So this is, so we optically modulate the Casimir force, and you know, there's a history, there's been earlier work on this from the 70s, we were not the first to think of this. But this was done in an earlier era where the sensitivities were not that high, instrumentation sensitivities were not that high. And also, you know, how to deal with systematic errors, such as electrostatic systematic errors, which are the biggest thing in these experiments, is the electrostatic force, which you have to know precisely and get rid of it before you make a Casimir force measurement. And these things were not worked out in these early days. So they saw things like, they saw the force actually decrease at short distances. The Casimir force, which should increase as the distance goes down at very short distances, they saw a decrease of the Casimir force, for example. Okay, so again, we use the same technique, a sphere on a cantilever, which is metal-coated, to give us an electrical path all the way from the sphere to the ground. And the plate, in this case, we use a semiconductor. And we do this experiment in vacuum, what, 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 8 torr and at room temperature. Okay? And so this is the sphere that we use. And the thickness of the gold is 82 nanometers, and the diameter is 197 microns. So here's how we do the experiment. So what we're going to do is, so we have a gold-coated sphere, and here we have a silicon surface. We shine light on the silicon surface, and we're going to make electron-hole pairs. And when we have a large density electron hole pairs, the permittivity, the epsilon of the silicon surface changes, which changes the Casimir force between the two surfaces. So when the light is on, the Casimir force is large. When the light is off, the Casimir force is smaller. And we look for the difference in the force with the light on and the light off. And we're measuring this difference. And that's the modulation, the Casimir force we're measuring. And we take the silicon by shining light. We go from a carrier density of about 10 to the 14, which is an impure dielectric. It's still not intrinsic, okay, impure dielectric, to 10 to the 19 per cc, which is a metallic phase of silicon. It's beyond the critical density. Okay, so we're going from the dielectric phase to the metallic phase. Now, if we want to have such a large density change, then we need carriers with a long lifetime, so we can achieve a high density, and we need small volumes, which means we need thin membranes. So we have to make a special sample. And we cannot go to a much lower carrier density than this. Ideally, you cannot go more than a factor of 100 less than this anyway. People, you know, there's always impurities in silicon, so you cannot avoid dopants. But we don't want to go lower than this because then we don't know how to compensate for the electrostatic effects, because you'll always have uncompensated charges if the carrier density is very small, and then we'll have electrostatic systematic errors, which we'll not know how to subtract out. So that's why we want to have a reasonable carrier density there, and then change the carrier density by about 10 to the 5, 100,000, so we can see a change in the Casimir force. So that's the goal here. So this gets to the point I was telling about the electrostatic effects. So we want to have, the surface has to be flat. That means we don't have to have traps, which trap electrostatic charges and give electrostatic systematic errors. So we have to control the electrostatic forces. We have to excite the bottom the silicon surface from the bottom, because we can't shine light from the side, because the photon pressure would be a big systematic on our setup. So we have to be careful to shine the light only from the top, and the transmitted light has to be very small. Okay, so we have to make sure the transmitted light is very small, which limits the thickness of this silicon surface to about greater than 3 microns, so the light doesn't transmit through and hit the sphere. So we don't get a radiation pressure systematic. Yes, so that limits how much power you can put, so, and that controls the volume. So we have a heating which is less than a degree. We will get a heating of the surface, but we have to make sure that it's very small. Okay, so we have to make the special surface, so we make it out of silicon wafer, just standard nanofabrication techniques where we open up a hole at the bottom and then eat through the bottom silicon until it stops at this white layer. And then, which is a silicon oxide layer, then we get rid of that by a different chemical. So we open up this hole through which we can shine the light, and then we have to do what's called a passivation technique to make sure we get rid of the defects on the surfaces, any electrostatic defects we have on the surfaces. So when we the density in the dark phase, that's when there's no light on, the carrier density is 5 times 10 to the 14, which we measure separately. And the thickness of this membrane is 4 microns. Okay. So, and then once we're done making the sample, we put it up here on top of a piezo, and here's a gold-coated sphere. So there's a semiconductor and a gold surface, and we measure the force. So we calibrate the system electrostatically, and the way we calibrate, apply voltages between the two surfaces and calibrate how much the cantilever bends. And the key thing I was telling you about is that we need to know how much the electrostatic force is, because we're using a silicon surface and a gold surface where the work functions are different, which means that there will always be a potential difference between the two surfaces. And this we have to know and make sure it doesn't change the function of separation distance. So we can do that electrostatically. Here's the electrostatic formula for the force between a sphere and a plate. And V is the voltage that you apply to one surface, in this case the plate. And V naught is the potential difference when there's no voltage applied. So the force corresponds only to the difference of the voltages. Okay, when what was applied compared to what was there originally because of the work function differences. That's a V naught. Okay, so we have to measure this V naught when we do the experiment. Okay, and we do that by applying different voltages V and just solving for V naught. That's the simplest way of doing it. And you got to make sure that this doesn't change as a function of separation distance. If it does, you cannot use a sample. That tells you have some multipolar effects like dipoles and octopoles and stuff which are coming in because the surface is dirty. So you can't use that sample, and you got to start all over again. Okay, so you got to measure. Yeah.
We had a couple of thousand.
Right.
Of this calibration.
Right.
Parabola.
Right. Yes.
Parabola is changing as a function.
Right. Right.
And there was always this issue of whether
yes.
Raises as a function of C or doesn't.
Yes. So that's what happens when you start with a new sample then. you don't use samples to show any of those dependence, because that tells you a couple of things. One, your surfaces have some defects, electrostatic defects on the surface, and also tells you that your it can come from defects on the surface or because there's spatial variation, let's say scratches on the surface, so which means that as you change the distance, the surface profile is effectively changing. Those two reasons will give you those kind of effects. So you start with a fresh sample then. Okay. So you don't use those samples.
How many samples do you have?
Okay, well, that's a good question. If, give you an example, when we started doing this 10 years ago, we used to, about 10% of the samples would be the ones that would work. For the lateral force experiments, because you're imprinting the corrugations, these defects are much larger, and hardly 1% of the samples work. Okay, so for regular Casimir force, you can deal with 10%, but for lateral force, it's almost 1%. Otherwise, you get all these electrostatic effects, which you have to keep doing over and over again till this baseline you get first, and then you make the Casimir force measurement after that. Yeah.
So, if I understand correctly, as soon as you detect the dependence of V0 on the separation, you discard the sample. Is that?
Yes. V0 is changing. That's a rule number one. You have an error bar. Typically, error bar. If in our case it's about 2 millivolts, if it's more than plus two minus two millivolts, we discard the sample. Okay, you don't use the sample because you know it's coming from electrostatic effects, which it means the sample is dirty or your surface is not smooth. Two things it can come from. Yeah.
These
are distance. Yes.
That formula for capacitance?
We calibrate interferometrically. So this is again a key. So you don't make the measurement. What happens is, if you apply, the way you change the separation distance is by applying voltage to this piezo. When you apply a voltage to this piezo, the piezo does expand. But if you apply a DC voltage, that is you stop, you apply a voltage and stop, there's always a time lag. That means the piezo continues to expand slowly. It's called creep. Okay, and especially if you're doing this at room temperature, this creep can be large. So you never do experiments with static voltages applied. You don't apply, 10 volts and then 11 volts and 12 volts. You never do experiments like that, as was done in a recent paper. Okay, you never, because of this creep, because of this separation distance creep. So what you do is you apply continuous voltages. That is, you don't wait. You apply the voltage goes from 0 to 100 continuously at very low frequency, so you give the piezo time to expand. And then you keep on repeating the experiment, so you get an average, and then you calculate the average separation interferometrically by using the same frequency. And then you can fit the two, and then you get a match. So you get an average separation, and you measure that average separation interferometrically separately by an optical interferometer. So that's how you avoid those problems. Okay. So you have to be careful. I mean, you have to take into account these things. And unfortunately, they're being rediscovered now. So you have to, or you do this at low temperature where there's no creep, then you can apply static voltages and keep the piezo fixed. So those two things you got to watch out for. What you get from the capacitance is, however, you have to get one value from the capacitance, which is the average separation distance, because you can never know, let me get to the second slide. So the calibration is done electrostatically, and that comes to your question that actually is addressed in the next slide. So here's some calibration curve that we do. Typically, what we do is we apply a DC voltage to the plate, and then on top of the DC voltage, we also apply a pulse. The reason we apply a pulse is we want to know only the difference in the forces, because we don't know what the baseline is precisely, so we want to measure only the differences. So that's why we apply a pulse on top of a DC voltage. Now, so that's the y-axis. That's how we calibrate the electrostatic force. That's the y-axis. Now, the distance is what your question was about. How do you measure distance? So there's three terms for the distance. One is the distance moved by the piezo. And I was telling you, if you want to do this at room temperature, you have to apply continuous voltages to the piezo. And you do this Z piezo, this one, you do this with an optical interferometer. You find out, how much the piezo is moving. With continuous voltage only, the same frequency apply and measure that out. Now, the other term that you don't know is this Z sub zero. This is the fact that because the surfaces have some, you're making a gold coating on a surface and you have some crystals on the surface and some of them are taller. And therefore, even when the two surfaces are touching each other, the separation distance is not zero. There's some average separation distance. So there's some average capacitance between the two. And you can get this by fitting the electrostatic curve here and try to find out, what the capacitance is. And that gives you this value of Z0. And here's another check. if this Z0 is changing as a function of separation distance, for example, you fit the curve only up to here, then you fit it up to here, so you fit it at different points, and you find out different values of Z0, that tells you there's a problem. You cannot use the data. Okay, that's not, so this is another check you have to keep. Not only the V0 has to be separation independent, the Z0, the capacitance on contact, has to be constant. Otherwise, you cannot use the data. Yeah.
What theoretical prediction do you use for the electrostatic force? Does it take into account some kind of roughness?
The electrostatic force, yeah. The, if you fit it, that's why you fit it at large distances.
Okay,
if your roughness is very small,
right.
The, yes.
If you go to short, you...
Yes, you don't fit it at very...
It doesn't know
yes.
about roughness.
It doesn't know about roughness, but you can take into account roughness too, which we have done.
Okay.
But it's a very small effect. But as long as you're fitting it at large distances, you don't worry about this. Yeah. That's a good question, yeah. Okay, so that's that capacitance that you brought up. So you have to know this, and you have to make sure, again, this is constant as a function of separation distance. It's not changing on you, the capacitance at contact, okay? And that's another giveaway when your surface is not good. Then the other one is, this is a very small effect, which is the fact that when you, since we make this, we're detecting the force through a tilt of the cantilever is actually tilting, which means that changes the separation distance. The cantilever tilts by angstroms. You know, we're looking at the deflection of the cantilever to measure the force, and it's a few angstrom tilt at the maximum. But when that moves by a few angstrom, the sphere gets closer to the plate by a few angstrom. So we have to know how much it's getting closer. So that's this effect, this factor M. So that tells us how much the sphere is getting closer to the plate. And that's a very small effect. That also you do it by applying different voltages. If you have a higher voltage, it tilts more. Smaller voltages tilts less, so by measuring the tilt as a function of the voltage, you can back out this value. Okay, so that's another thing. So those are the things that gives you the separation distance, and you make sure. Okay. So here's how we do the experiment then. So we have this membrane, that's a silicon membrane. We shine light from the bottom, that's a green light, and we use an argon laser, and we pulse the laser. So we apply 5 millisecond pulses using this function generator and this thing called a acousto-optic modulator, which just chops up the light beam into pulses. And synchronous with this pulse, the same instrument that makes the pulses also is connected to the plate. We change the voltages on the plate. And the reason we do this, anytime we shine light on this membrane and increase the carrier density of the membrane, we change its work function slightly by a few millivolts. And that's an electrostatic systematic in our experiment, and so we have to know how much this few millivolt changes because of changing the carrier density. That's why we apply this voltage, which is synchronous with the pulse, and find out from that, from the electrostatic force, we'll back out how much this change in this work function is, which is the V0. And the change of the force, so when you shine light, the permittivity changes, the Casimir force changes between these two surfaces, and that results in a deflection of the cantilever, change in deflection of the cantilever, which we measure with this Locken amplifier. Okay? So those are the two things that we do. So here's how the formula looks. So the change in the force has an electrostatic component. This is the change in the electrostatic force, and this is a change in the Casimir force. So the force, total force, comes from a change in the electrostatic force and a change in the Casimir force. Now, if you look at the electrostatic force, it has two terms. This is the parabolic thing that you were telling about, right? It always changes parabolic with a voltage, and that's how we measure the V0. And this is the, so these are two terms. The reason you have two terms is one has a superscript L and the other doesn't. So these are, this is the residual potential difference, the difference in the work function when the light is on. That's what L means, when the light is on. This is when the light is off, okay? And so we have to know those separately because we are putting a light beam, which is pulsed. Here the light is on, here the light is off. So we have to know the work function is different when the light is on, the work function is different when the light is off. So we have to know these separately, okay? And we can get those from the parabolic dependence. So what we do is... Excuse me?
Capacitance is the same.
Yeah, because it's just a sphere versus a plate formula. So the capacitance is just the same in both cases. Yeah. Yeah. So the geometry is the same, so for the capacitance is the same. Okay, only the work function is changing now, so we have to know these things. So so we have these 5 millisecond pulses, and of course delta FC is the Casimir force, the difference when the light is on compared to when the light is off. That's what we measure. So we apply these voltages, some voltage when the light is off, some voltage when the light is on, V and VL, VL and V, and we measure the total force. But the total force is parabolic in V, L, and V. And from this, we can solve for this the zero terms, these zero terms, and then we can subtract out the electrostatic force and get the Casimir force. And that's how we do the experiment. So, and this is the parabolic dependence we were alluding to before. So here's the same thing I've written again. So VL and V are the applied synchronous voltages when the light is on and the light is off. And these are the work function differences when the light is on and the light is off. And the way you do this is first you apply some constant V here, and then you keep on changing this V super L. And you get this parabola in V sub L. And the peak of this parabola will give you this term, V zero L. Okay? And you repeat this, keep on applying different Vs, and you get a parabola, and then the top of the parabola will give you V sub zero. So that's how you solve for these. And you gotta make sure that these Vs, of course, are separation independent, and that's when you solve for it, okay? And so once you get these two terms, then you can put them in to the formula, get the electric force and subtract it out, and you'll get the Casimir force.
So let me answer.
Okay.
You vary both V and VL.
Yes.
And make sure that that formula works.
Works, yes, yes. And I got to this parabolic dependence was actually shown in a, this was the first, I would say the first paper to work out all the systematics in the Casimir force detection was this paper by Overbeek and Von Vleugelen. Okay, this was a 78 paper. This is where they really worked out, first really understood how to do, worry about the electrostatic systematic and propose this parabolic dependence to solve for the V sub zero. Okay, and this was the first paper that actually subtracted out the electrostatic systematic. Before that, nobody had worried about the electrostatic systematic. And they then measured the Casimir force. They, of course, it was still, so at least they got rid of the systematics and they were able to measure a force and show that it's an attractive force. Though numerically, they didn't do any, they did solve and compare it to the theory, but it wasn't a very rigorously done theory. But at least they were sure that it's an unambiguous attractive force with changes as a function of separation distance, and for the first time subtracted out electrostatic systematics way back in 78. Yeah?
Which reference is this?
This is Transactions of the Faraday Chemical Society.
One or two?
Good question. They ask me this all the time. I think it's two, but I can tell you later. Chromium. Chromium. Yeah, they're for chromium. And they actually took into account the band gap and stuff. They're worried about the oxide. Chromium, always, the problem with chromium, and nobody uses it because it forms an oxide. They at least worried about it and tried to find out what the effects of the oxide layer is. And so, yeah.
Did anybody think about patch fields on the
world? Yes, that's what gives you these multipolar effects. So if you have surfaces, if let's say you have a gold surface, and you have places where the V naught is different because it's absorbing some chemical or something. If you do as a function of separation distance, you'll pick it up.
Yep.
And that's the key. You have to have the separation independence of the V sub zero. Otherwise, you don't use a sample. Okay. So you solve for this V zero, L and V zero, and you plug into the electric force, and you subtract it out, and the difference would be the Casimir force. So that's how we do it. Find out what the Casimir force is, and this is the result for one power, 9.3 milliwatts. The squares are the data points as a function of separation distance. That's the difference Casimir force. The maximum is about 3.5 piconewtons. That's the maximum force we get. Now we have to talk about the errors and how to compare with the theory. Okay, but before we get there, to apply the theory, we have to know what carrier density we have in the silicon membrane. So we have to know that we made the required number of carriers, and the way we do that is by looking at the change in the reflectivity. So we shine light on it, we make these carriers. Since the permittivity is changed, the reflectivity of the semiconductor surface changes. And we can probe the reflectivity by using the second laser, which is 1.3 micron. Its photon energy is much smaller than the band gap energy, so it doesn't excite any carriers, but just looks at the change in the reflectivity of the silicon surface. Okay? So, and that's the change in the reflectivity as a function of time. And by fitting this, we can get the lifetime of the carrier. So we independently make a measurement of the same membrane. We measure the lifetime of the carriers. And we can measure it as a function of density. And in this case, we just measured it at two particular points. It's about 0.4 milliseconds. And at low carrier density, it's a little longer, closer to half a millisecond. Okay, so we make an independent measurement with the same membrane and make sure that we have the carrier density that we have, that we should have. And then we can calculate the carrier density. So we measure the lifetime. We know the power that we are putting into the membrane, the laser power. But unfortunately, the laser power is not is a Gaussian function. So we have to find out how much of the power goes into some average power that goes into the Gaussian beam width of the laser beam. And then we find the carrier density there. And these are the carrier densities of these three laser powers. The biggest error that we have is, of course, coming from the carrier density. So when we fit the theory, the error bar in the theory is going to be given by our uncertainty in the carrier density. Okay, so that'll give us a band. And this is all at a 95% confidence level, which means twice the error bar in uncertainties. The factor of 2 has been multiplied there. Okay, so here are the epsilons for the silicon. So this is what you get if it's a dielectric. And these are the terms you add: a plasma frequency due to the electrons, a plasma frequency due to the holes. System, okay? And you can, these are the gamma factors, the losses that come in. We just look it up in from the literature. And these are the plasma frequencies for the holes and the electrons. And then you can plot this permittivity for the silicon as a function of this imaginary frequency. The dashed line, of course, is the dielectric silicon. That's the dashed line, it's flat. We have 10 to the 14 carriers, even when there's no light, that gives us this Drude type behavior here in the epsilon. And when the light is on, you get these three colored curves. So these are the curves that come about when the light is 9.3, 8.5 milliwatts, or 4.7 milliwatts. Okay. So we're changing the permittivity from here to here, and we're changing the Casimir force. So the Casimir force coming from the change in the permittivity.
What about the thermal diffusion of carriers in the material?
Yes, so that'll be some
non-locality in the
atmosphere. Yes, so that we haven't taken those into account here. Yeah, that's not taken into account. And that could be you can comment on it at the end of the talk, you'll tell.
So lower powers than conventional powers in the laser, particularly if the separation is comparable to the bi-string.
Yes. I have some. We'll talk about that as we go. Yes. Okay. So here's the experiment I just showed you, the force of the functional separation distance, and that's the data. And now we can apply the theories on it. So the dashed line is where the DC conductivity has been included, both for when there's no light on it and when there's light on it. Okay. So we're taking the difference but the DC conductivity is included in the dielectric phase as well as the metallic phase for the silicon. Okay. And that's what you get from the black dashed line. The gamma is for the 10 to the 14 carriers also we put in. Okay. The red line is when the conductivity has been included in the metallic phase. So the metal has conductivity, okay, but the dark phase, when there's no light, they are taking it as a static dielectric constant, like Lipschitz did, you know, putting a epsilon naught, which is just a static permittivity for it. Okay, that's the red line. This one here, the short dashed line, is a zero temperature force. Like I think Emig was saying, when it's a zero for temperature force, there's no problem, and everything is okay. Okay, when you do the zero temperature approximation, everything's okay. There's no problem, everything agrees. So that's what you get from the dashed line. You can put conductivity, you can put relaxation, anything you want, there's no problem, everything agrees. Okay, so the only thing is inclusion of the DC conductivity in the high resistivity silicon does not agree with the results. Okay, yeah.
Can you go back 2 slides? I'm not quite sure. So what is the right way of doing it? So I understood that including gamma
yes.
Creates difficulties.
The problem is we don't know what the right way of doing it is. At least I don't know. And I'll tell you, I'll comment on it as I go.
Yes.
I don't know what is the right way.
Okay.
I don't know what is the right way. All that I can tell you is the zero temperature Lipschitz formula works fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, I can tell you that. I can tell you leaving out the conductivity in the dark phase works fine.
What do you mean zero temperature works fine?
That means the integral form of the Lipschitz.
It's not really.
Gamma doesn't matter.
Oh, for gamma, just
yeah.
For gamma.
I can put I put the permittivity in with gamma, without gamma, no difference. I get the right result.
The temperature shouldn't make a big difference.
Precisely, yes. So physically, yes, precisely, you know, the temperature should not make a difference. And that makes sense that zero temperature agrees with it because, as I said, we are measuring the forces at 100 nanometers. The thermal spectrum is at 7 microns. So the thermal spectrum should not perturb Casimir force measurements at 100 nanometers. So that makes sense. Physically, the zero temperature force agreeing with the results makes perfect sense.
Is it coupled to your remark about these strong effects of the 100 nanometers temperature correction? Or
yes, so this is part, that will be in there too. But that's also part of the so if you put the finite temperature formula in, then we'll get that the temperature effect is in the prediction right there. But it's not entirely coming from just the thermal photons. It's coming from the gamma, from the relaxation parameter. Because you know, if you put a static dielectric constant for the silicon, everything is okay too. So it's just not the thermal effect alone. Okay, because the static dielectric constant, everything's okay.
What was the temperature here?
300 Kelvin, yeah. 300 Kelvin, yeah.
So I guess I'm not understanding something.
Okay.
So there is a formula, the Lipschitz formula, that gives the correct zero temperature.
Yes.
And that works.
That works.
And then you say there's using the same formula, but now in a different reorganization where you do in terms of frequency.
Right.
And using finite temperature, it doesn't
work. It doesn't work.
Does this mean that you're just reorganizing the same
formula? You would think. You think, because zero temperature is an approximation, of course, right? We're doing the experiment at 300 Kelvin. Right? So going to the zero temperature limit means that we are assuming that the temperature doesn't play a role, which is true. I mean, intuitively, that is correct. But if you believe the complete Lipschitz formula in terms of the sums and apply 300 Kelvin, then you get these anomalies.
Doesn't that mean that you plug into Lipschitz formula the wrong material?
Absolutely. Probably absolutely true. That's possibly right. Or we're ignoring some effects that should be taken into account, which for that formula is not valid for. Those are two options we have. Okay? And you know.
You said, I mean, that your results
yeah.
And temperature should not play.
And intuitively, temperature should not. But people who argue about using the summation formula with the Drude result will argue, no, their thermal prediction is correct one. I mean, they will argue that.
I would say that too.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, and this is valid. Okay. Yeah.
But is the problem now really in the Lipschitz formula or in the dispersion relation that's being used?
You know, here's my intuition. I mean, as we discussed, you know, the Lipschitz formula has some assumptions in it. Okay, it's made for perfect thermal equilibrium. Okay, and infinite surfaces. Okay, those are the assumptions which are part of the Lipschitz formula. Perhaps.
And local dielectric function.
Local dielectric function. Yes. No spin. No non-locality. Okay. So those are the assumptions in it. So perhaps we are not following those assumptions when you apply the formula. That's the, you know, that's a problem maybe.
There have been generalized dispersion relations suggested.
Generalized dispersion relations.
Yeah. I saw your paper.
So I'll show you. There have been some generalizations of this, including non-locality. Is that what?
Yes.
Okay. Is that what you're referring to? Okay. So I will compare that to the data, and I'll show you. Okay. So that's as far as this is concerned. And we can do this for other laser powers. So this is at another laser power, 8.5 milliwatts. Again, the zero temperature formula, which you intuitively think you should agree, agrees. Okay. And if you neglect the DC conductor in the dark phase, again, it agrees. I mean, they're not the same, they don't overlap, but at least within our experimental error, we cannot tell the difference between the two, okay? But the minute you put the DC conductivity for the dielectric phase, it's above our experimental error. That's the difference, okay? And
the two you cannot really differentiate.
We cannot tell. You know, they're different, but within our error bars, we cannot tell which one is, okay. Okay, we cannot tell. And this is for a third laser power, again. 4.7 milliwatts. Again, the dotted line is a zero temperature result. The solid line is no DC conductivity in the dark phase. The dashed line is a DC conductivity again. Okay, so including the DC conductivity doesn't agree with the results for the dark phase of silicon. Okay, and then we can look at the error bars. So here are all the error bars from the experiment. Okay, listing of all the error bars. The total systematic error at 95% confidence. We multiply it by a factor of 2. The experimental random error. Changes as a function of distance. Now we can add up the total experimental errors, and then this is where the roughness comes in. We measure the roughness of all the crystals, and the roughness effect is about 1% at the close of separation, and it's less than 1% at large separation. So it's a very small factor in our experiment.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yeah.
If you include the DC conductance, the reflectivity should increase, isn't it?
Yes, precisely.
Expect a stronger?
No, because you're subtracting out a bigger reflectivity. That's why it goes down. See, the dashed line is a change in the Casimir force. Reflectivity when it's dark minus reflectivity when it's high. So since you're including the conductivity here.
Also in the dark phase.
In the dark phase.
Oh, okay,
high phase, you need it. If you don't have it in high phase, then you don't have a change.
In the dark phase.
Yeah, dark phase. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm with you. Yeah, I know. Okay, so here are the theoretical errors. Again, the biggest uncertainty comes from the fact that we don't know the carrier density precisely. Okay, it's a 20% error. And the fact that we don't know the separation distance precisely. Those are the two big errors on how to match the theory with the experiment. Okay, and so then we can, you know, so here's the theoretical uncertainties as a function of separation. Here's the experimental uncertainties as a function of separation. We can calculate the total uncertainty, theory plus experiment, and that'll give the total error bars. So if the deviation from experiment and theory lie within the total error bar, then we cannot tell the difference between the theory and the experiment. But if it lies outside the error bar, then we know the theory is ruled out. Okay, and this is at a 95% confidence level. That means we multiplied all the errors by a factor of 2. So to within 95%, we can tell whether the theory agrees or not. And so this is how. So here are the error bars of the experiment. And this is the no DC conductivity result, and the zero temperature also will be right close to it. And this is the result with the DC conductivity. And you can actually look at it better. Here's how. So what you see here is this axis, the force axis, the separation distance axis. The solid line here, the red solid line, is the total error bars, theory plus experiment, at the 95% confidence level. And what the x-axis is experiment minus theory. So you take your theory, you have your experimental data, you subtract the two. Okay? So essentially, you're looking only at the noise in the data. Okay? Noise in the data within the error bars. So you see, if you have the, here's the blue ones are where the DC conductivity is not included for the dark phase. That lies within the 95% confidence level. This, of course, this error bars include theory and experiment error bars here. So it lies within it. Whereas this one is lying outside it. So it tells us that that theory is then excluded at a 95% confidence level. That's all we can say. Okay? And we do that for three different laser powers. Okay. Yeah?
Why do you think this modulation is?
Oh, the modulation, this is a noise in the experiment. The modulation is a noise in the experiment. And the way the noise is coming from, since we're using what's called this Locken amplifier, which is measuring the change at the same phase as the pulses. The light pulses are coming in. Okay? So it's phase matched to the light pulse. Now, if the force is very small, the phase wanders. Okay, the force is very small. Essentially, signal to noise is very small. Okay, so the phase wanders. So you'll see this is the oscillation, the wandering in the phase between the light pulse and a detection. That's where we get this modulation from. Okay, essentially coming from the lifetime, averaging time of our amplifier.
You have also a systematic shift to positive numbers, isn't it? I mean.
Yeah, for these two theories. That's the thing we brought up, because if you include the reflectivity at the dark phase, the force always goes lower. That's all you're saying here. That's a positive shift. And this was somebody else's question. Is it the problem with gamma in this case? In this case, it is just not gamma, because you can drop the gamma out, you can go towards the plasma model, and we cannot tell the difference between a plasma model and within our experimental errors. For example, the plasma model is a green line, the Duda model is a red line. We can't tell the difference. So it's not within experimental errors, it's not a problem just with the gamma. In this experiment, it has to do with the conductivity of silicon. So whether you use a static dielectric constant or not, yeah.
So when you say it's not gamma, the other place I suppose is omega p different.
It's omega p. It's omega p. Yes.
So that's
right. Yeah. But there is a difference. But we cannot tell. There is a difference of gamma too. But we cannot tell within our experimental error, which is clear. Yeah. So this is another experiment. How are we doing? Okay. So this is another experiment where they measured the oscillation of a Bose-Einstein condensate. So they took a rubidium Bose-Einstein condensate and its oscillations on top of a silicon plate they measured. And the oscillation correspond to the Casimir polar force. And this was published last year. And there also you see the same problem. if you use, so here's the this oscillation frequency, which corresponds to the Casimir force as a function of separation distance. The crosses are the experiments. Now, the solid line is what you get if you neglect, if you assume that the silica glass is a perfect dielectric, that is epsilon naught, no conductivity. The minute you put any non-zero conductivity in it, you get this dashed line, which is outside the experimental error bars. Okay, and they repeated this for three different temperatures also. Okay, so you, in every case, you get the fact that you put any non-zero conductivity in the glass, any ionic conductivity, all glasses have some ionic conductivity, and you put it in, and then it will not agree. The data. Okay. So it's the same thing that we noticed in the dielectrics. If you put in a conductivity, you get a disagreement. Now, and now there has been, in the last 6 months, there have been a lot of preprints proposing modifications of the Lipschitz theory, and all based on the screening idea, which, as far as I can, was in Parsegian's book in 2005. He proposed an idea, which is the following, that he said, so the Lipschitz formula is made for infinite surfaces. But since all experiments use finite surfaces, the zero frequency field, which is where all the problems are associated with, the zero frequency field, the zero Matsubara frequency term, will be screened out, because his idea is the fact that when the static field is applied, since it's a finite body, it'll quickly accumulate within a picosecond or so, accumulate charges on the outside, and screen out any static field. That was the idea. So that's why the zero frequency term, he said, has to be modified in the Lipschitz formula when applied to finite samples. I think that was some related to your question, I believe, right? So this was his proposal in 2005, and that's been taken a first step further in the last 3 months. There have been a lot of preprints based on, I shouldn't say based on, because his reference is not there, but idea of screening. And
what do you put in for the effective bicycle length?
Okay, so these are not my papers. These are just models of other people. So they modify the zero Matsubara term different ways, including screening. And we are just comparing in this case, these are error bars at 70% confidence level here, not 95%. And this is the modified theory, okay, including screening. And that's one, in this case, the Debye-Huckel screening. And for our parameters, the screening length, the Debye radius, is about 200 nanometers. Okay, 200 nanometers in our case. And I can get you the exact number later, but it's around 200 nanometers.
And the separations are?
And for at the illuminated thing, in the illuminated case, it's hardly a nanometer or less. Okay, it's metallic, right? So it's all, but in the dark phase, when there's no light, it's an order of 200 nanometers. And your question was?
What's the separation?
Separation distance is not 100 nanometers. It's 100 to 200 nanometers. And then there's...
Excuse me, just one.
Yeah.
So in the metallic case, I guess the zero frequency term is completely screened out. You just leave it out.
Parsegian's this thing. But here they're not. They have modified the zero frequency term to take into account screening. Okay. So here's a modification. So the reflection coefficient is modified by this is a modified term here, okay, which in this case takes Debye-Huckel screening into account. And these authors just include diffusion and diff currents using a Boltzmann type equation. But the problem then goes back to, as somebody was pointing out, then you have real currents, diff currents, which means that you have losses and you don't have thermal equilibrium here anymore. By putting this in, you violated thermal equilibrium. And so there are other problems to putting in screening effects.
Let me just add a little comment.
Okay.
The zero frequency term, of course, is just classical statistical mechanics.
Yes, classical, yes.
Treatment of the whatever Coulomb problem you have.
Right.
And the way it's calculated in all these theories, the so-called screening of van der Waals effect, is done in such a way that you assume that the mean distribution is constant, and then you look at the fluctuations around that.
Okay.
That's an approximation, of course. In reality, it's not constant. It has a mean field profile, and in principle, you should take that into account, which will modify the result that you get for the zero frequency curve. I'm not sure how far one should put this in terms of the in terms of how realistic these models are.
You're talking about the real equilibrium density of the plasma as a function of separation into distance into the sample, so that the surface profile.
Absolutely, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because here it's taken in an idealist form, it's just a box. I know that for other cases, let me give you an example. If you look at the, a counter ion only system between two surfaces. There, of course, these effects are important. Here, I don't know.
Yeah.
But in principle, they're also there.
How do you take into account,
First of all, I would need to know whether it's worth pushing in that direction, because it's not easy.
Well, here there's experimental results, two of them, right? I would tell you there's obviously something has to be modified. I don't know whether your approach is the right one or not.
Maybe it's worth one.
I think so. If that is, it's worth a try.
So the Pitelyevsky paper is the one that this has been.
The three papers. Pitelyevsky paper. There's this approach is again same putting screening term based on the Pitelyevsky approach, but here they use a Boltzmann equation and drift currents, which is again problematic. Again, if you have a drift current with a different direction, and they treat the electric field coming from the electric field with a 0.4 photon, which is kind of strange because the fluctuating field should have a zero expectation value, but they put a non-zero expectation value to get the drift current because it's a Boltzmann type equation here. And so they've solved this again, and here's our experiment, the crosses are the experiments. The band, the solid band, is the theory, not taking into account the DC conductivity, and the reason you get a band is because of the uncertainty in the carrier concentration. So you get a band in the theory, that's uncertainty in the theory.
And this would be also the TF0 result.
This is all finite, in terms of the expansion, Matsubara expansion. And the dotted line is what you would get from the theory, if you applied the theory of this drift current, okay? Which again, as I said, violates equilibrium conditions also. So it doesn't completely agree with our experiment at the 70% confidence level. And this is another theory, again a skinning theory, again published in the last few weeks, where he introduces spatial dispersion and the random phase approximation. And he assumes since we have only a finite boundary, the random phase approximation is for infinite samples, he assumes specular reflection of the boundaries, for example. And so he makes some assumptions and then calculates the permittivity due to Thomas Fermi screening and thereby modifies the Lipschitz formula. And
so this is spatial dispersion for the two semi...
Yes, semi-spaces.
A spatial dispersion in between is very difficult to do.
It's
completely separate.
And that's why you have to make all these assumptions and how you treat it.
Specular refraction, what does that mean?
It's a sentence I just thrown in the paper which just says that, I'm going to neglect it. That's the effect of it. Okay, I'm going to neglect the effect of the boundary altogether. That's right.
That specular reflection
of the electron, the charges.
It's not of the light.
Yeah, not of the light, the electrons. The electron is.
Into account in the properties of epsilon, just this way, right? You just assume some symmetry for epsilon of z, comma z prime. Specular refraction is like one boundary condition, anti-specular, it's another one, dielectric, a third one, and there's a couple of other ones also. But it really doesn't encompass any physics. It just caps it itself.
Okay. So they calculate, they modify their Lipschitz formula using the technique, and then they actually made a comparison only to our experiment. They took the data from one of our papers, but didn't realize that the error bars were given at the error bars on the experiment were 70%, and then they put the error bars on the theory at 95%, and they got a matching in the paper. But we just redid this and found that if the error bars are put properly, 70% for the theory and 70% for the experiment, which you compare at the same confidence level, then they don't match exactly. They're not a overlap in the experiment. It's closer. It's closer when compared to the theory, the discrepancy before. Putting the screening term brings it closer. It's not the theory matches, does not match only at a 70% confidence level. Before, it did not match at a 95% confidence level. Okay, so it's getting closer. Putting the screening term brings it closer. Okay, so it's in the right direction, but it's still.
How the screening idea got revived, obviously, after 40 years. I think it's the first person to calculate screening effects was Smilga in the 70s.
I see.
A Russian guy.
Oh, I didn't even know that. No.
Yeah. But then it kind of died off, and now apparently it's hot.
Just a stupid idea. Could you not just try, I mean, since you have a strong temperature dependence, play with it? I mean, just cool
your system down. We tried this. We tried actually many years ago, 2003. We heat the system up, actually.
Okay.
It's easier to do. But the systematics were, because temperature changes introduced a lot of systematic errors in a can over, and so our noise was huge and we couldn't tell. So now we're doing an experiment. We've been doing it for 2-3 years where we cool it down, which we're going the other direction. So we've been doing that for about 2 years, 2.5 years, but no results yet. Yeah. So this is not our experiment. This is an experiment by Decca, who we'll hear from next week, okay, where they have a precision measurement on metallic plates, gold plates. Okay, and there the precision is on the order of 0.2%. Again, experimental precision, experimental errors over force measures, 0.2%. Okay, and there you can see the uncertainty in the theory gives you this band. That's the band from the uncertainty in the theory. The crosses are the experimental data, and the solid line is the plasma model for gold. That's no gamma factor. That's all in the solid line. Okay, and that also has a band because of the uncertainty in the properties of the gold coating. Okay, so both are bands, and this is what I mean by looking at comparing the theory and experiment as a function of separation. You don't make a comparison at one point and say I'm off by 0.1%. You compare it as a function of separation, and then see how the disagreement is. Because of the nonlinearity of the Casimir force, the two curves are not parallel. They slightly diverge from each other, and you can tell this. So anytime you put a different metal property in it into the Lipschitz formula, the two curves are not parallel. They follow different curvatures, and you can compare these two and pull out the differences as long as the experimental error bar is very small. In this case, an order of 0.2%. Okay. All right. So that's my conclusion. I talked about the optical modulation of the Casimir force and show that the results have the right distance dependence. When compared to the zero temperature formula. But there are some discrepancies if you include the DC conductivity for the dielectric phase of silicon. Okay, and the same problems you notice for the Bose-Einstein condensate. And acknowledge all my collaborators and Feng Chen, Castillo Garza, Chiu, and Chang are my students and postdoc. And theory, we had theoretical help from Mostar Penneko and Klimchitskaya, and funding from NSF and DOE. Thank you. Yeah?
You told us in the beginning about the puzzle of the 1/2 factor.
Yes.
Is there an experimental evidence existing about
the 1/2 would be the 1/2 of the Casimir force, right? Which is the ideal metal result, which means you have to measure the Casimir force at very large distances. I'm talking, millimeters. So right now, the best the Casimir force can be measured to with good precision is about 760 nanometers, which is an experiment you'll hear about tomorrow, or next week, I think, right? And there is where they can see this. Rule out the 1/2 factor by similar things. They can see that the band of the theory curves will be outside the experimental error bar. So they can rule out not the 1/2 factor per se, but the effect of putting in this gamma into the permittivity. They can rule that out. Yeah?
So you discard samples which show evidence of drift in the zero potential.
Yes.
But what is your argument against correcting for this drift? I understand there are patches, but
yeah.
Aren't they correctly taken into
account? Well, if you can. You have to know exactly what the value of V0 is and apply this residual potential or subtract this out, and then you can do it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But we, for us, if it's a dirty sample, it's a dirty sample. Why use a sample? you know, then you don't know the surface properties at all. Yeah.
Yeah, I have two questions. So first, to the Lifshitz formula, is it correct to say that the Lifshitz formula works fine as long as we are dealing with metals, both metals, and on one hand, on the other hand, with dielectrics, but the trouble that's in when we consider the crossover?
Well, the Lifshitz formula works fine as long as a zero temperature version is used for sure. Doesn't matter what you do. Okay, that's one statement we can clearly make. When you come to a metal, the Lifshitz formula works fine as long as the relaxation term, the gamma term, losses are not put into the metal permittivity. The minute you put losses in it, you get these puzzles. Okay, in the case of metal. A similar thing happens for dielectric, but a little different. It's just not losses, any conductivity at all in a dielectric, which is effectively the losses in a dielectric. You put in, it doesn't work as well. Okay? So in a dielectric, you put conductivity in, it doesn't work well. In a metal, you put losses in, it doesn't work well.
Okay. Second question is related to the experiment. So in principle, one could think of to take this method, modulating the cosmic force by laser light, to actually modulating it dynamically, so some frequency, for example, into the laser light, so make the Casimir force varying with some frequency, and
I mean, you have some resonant. You mean
dynamic modulation, so change the Casimir force over time and use this effect, for example, in connection with an oscillator, Casimir oscillator.
No, but but that is what this is, right? Because the Casimir force is changing, it's being pulsed here.
Yeah.
It's being pulsed.
It's an experiment, but to do it in different ways, or maybe target it.
You can target it. Maybe you can put some resonant material or something, and then put some, tune, change the resonance, and then modulate the Casimir force that way. Is that what you're alluding to? Yeah, we could do that. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can. We did have one paper just to temperature modulate, for example. We have a paper where we have just theory calculations on similar schemes, where one, we just take a material from the metal to from insulator to a metal phase, for example. That way you modulate the Casimir force by shining light on it. That's another way, somewhat related to what you have. Different from here, where we're just putting carriers into the surface here. And you can also do the same thing where we have one scheme where you have you get this repulsive effect if the dielectric constants are arranged to go in one progression, that is epsilon 1, the top surface being greater than the liquid surface in the middle being greater than the bottom surface, then you have this, if you have this arrangement of dielectric constants, you get a repulsive Casimir force. One can do the following, that you start out with a case which doesn't obey this dependence, then you shine light on one surface and take it to this dielectric dependence, and so you go from attractor to repulsor. You could do things like that also, modulate the gas. Yeah.
You have the rare case that you see an experimental strong effect, I mean, between a dark light phase and that theory.
It's stronger than would be predicted by just putting in the conductivities for all the materials. Yes.
How sure? I mean, you are now affected or tuned with the dark side of the. How sure are you that you have a correct conductivity?
You know, see, the thing is. You can put any small conductivity, right? It's still, the effect will be as bad. You know, this is what's shown by, you know, this is seen actually from experiment, even this experiment, right? You put any small conductivity you want for the SiO2.
Okay.
You'll see a big deviation. That's what's non-physical about the whole result, about the using the Lifshitz formula. Any non-negligible conductivity to the dielectric destroys agreement. Any small
amount. Independent from that?
Oh yeah, here you have only the dark side.
Yeah, only the dark. Yeah, yeah.
The indielectric's part of the conductivity you're talking about is probably due to ionic process.
Yes, ionic process, exactly.
The question is, in the theory, do you put this in as a simply a frequency-independent extra bit of a magnetic field?
Yes, it's not my theory. It's a very good question, and I had something say that has to do with this fact here. So for the entropy to go to zero, you have to have the, it'll happen if you have an intrinsic semiconductor. If you put the screening idea, the entropy goes to zero. If you have an intrinsic semiconductor, then the carrier density will go to zero and everything's okay. But in the case of ionic conductivity, like you point out, the ions are still there. The number of ions doesn't go to zero. The mobility goes to zero. But the density doesn't go to zero, so the entropy will not go to zero as t goes to zero, the minute you just, for glasses.
I was more interested in the frequency dependence of what you see from that, because, I mean, the fluctuations that are causing the subtraction are presumably at reasonably finite frequencies, whereas, putting in the DC conductivity for something like ionic conduction, the frequencies of the fluctuations that we're interested in might not be the right thing to do. In other words, it might be that at the relevant frequencies, the ions can't move. They're heavier, after all, in some sense, than the electrons. So you might get away with this if you sort of, by promoting the conductivity at your interesting frequencies is essentially zero, even though there are ionic movements inside.
They put in an ionic conductivity, but they don't.
I think it needs a strong frequency defense. I'd like to have to look at that.
Yeah, Petersky is the one who did recently putting it in. Yeah.
Well, he must be old,
isn't he? I guess so.
This is a famous figure you hear all the time. Yeah. Where is he?
He's in Italy now, Florence.
Okay, so.
You showed us a curve obtained at exactly zero temperature, a theoretical curve.
Theoretical curve, yes.
But that was still including some conductivity.
Yes, yeah, conductivity for everything. It doesn't matter.
It's not. I mean, it's not the zero temperature Casimir frost that we know.
It has a conductivity.
Yeah, so what you said about the fact that the factor two could be distinguished experimentally as well.
Because
it's also still including these.
So you mean when I talk about this experiment, which you'll hear too next week, but so that's a deviation. So this is where you include the gamma factor of the metal in.
Yeah.
In this case, screening is also included here, but even without screening, the deviation will be bigger, but there'll be a band. And this is the theory without any gamma factor, any Debye screening, any Debye scattering.
Seem to join a bit.
Oh, you mean at large distances? But they don't have experimental precision, so you won't be experimentally be able to tell. The error bars will get bigger at large distances.
Because what I want to say is that at these large temperatures, it's not a problem of a factor two. The factor two problem is an idealization.
Factor two is an idealization, yes. You get only half the contribution if they put this Debye scattering term into the Lipschitz formula and take it to large separation distances.
Okay. It doesn't seem that there is there is not a factor two.
No, this is not very. This is only 700 nanometers. I'm talking millimeter. In ideal limit, will happen in millimeter separation.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is typically we continue these discussions, so questions are not cut off. We continue at 12:30 in the founder's room, right? So you have half an hour to go and get your sandwiches or food, and we continue with these discussions for another, half an hour, And then maybe we can also talk about at that time for this evening, if we have some dinner or something else to show us.
Yeah, the dinner should be at the if we get a reservation at the beachside cafe, which is next to the Junita Beach. Yeah. Just walk down to the beach. Yeah. 10 minutes walk from there. So it's the only place, the only restaurant at the beach. And I think the idea is that we go there. Early enough to get their special early bird classes before 6 p.m. So, but send an email
and to all of you to inform you about it later on.
So today, colloquium.